Greg Proulx.
Yo, pretty ladies around the world. Ja Wobble and the Invaders of the Heart. That's who does the jam that opens the show. Good evening. Welcome, Harks and Alarms. I'm Greg Proulx, and this is the Smartest Man in the World Proulxcast, commencing right now tonight. June 1st is the night we're recording here in the wilds of Western Hollywood at the inimitable, irrevocable Bar Lubitsch here in the dusky confines of this neighborhood. If you can only sit where I'm sitting, there's nudes on either side of me, and I use them as my spirit guides as this night wanders on. I suggest the people here drink, and I suggest the people listening at home, and particularly driving, smoke as much weed as they can get down. Because that's what this Proulxcast is all about. When we left off last episode, I'd been talking about seeing Ella Fitzgerald when I was an infant, because of course I wouldn't have been old enough to actually remember her. The 80s are but vague to me, as I was born in the late part of them. And thank you, that was supposed to be a joke, but I'll take everybody's horrible side eye as an indication of how little that shit's going to play tonight. When we finished the last Proulxcast, there were two questions that remained unanswered. As you know, we take questions here, and you may email us at smartest@aspecialthing.com. Look, I remembered it. And now, 6 months into the Proulxcast, and I've remembered the email address you can get me on. Thank you. I don't look at them beforehand, nor have I prearranged anything. I've been given this sheet that I have not looked at, but I'll be getting to that later. This is the one from last time. And by the way, there's so much to talk about. We're going to jump right in. I just wanted to start with the questions from last time because unfinished business, messy. This is like student council. I'm going to read the minutes from last meeting, and then we're going to move on into the comedy for the new meeting because I'm aware that shit has happened in the interim. For goodness sake, Obama went to England and gave a toast to the Queen through her anthem. So there's so much to really get to here. Where does one start? This was a question that was posed to me by Rebecca Renee and et al. Get it? No, that's what they wrote, Rebecca Renee et al. So I assume there's two girls named Rebecca and Renee, and that there's others in the group with them, but I'm supposed to simply know them by their Latin luffix, if you will. I'm supposed to know them by their posterior, by that I mean the ending. Et al., meaning I guess the rest of in Latin, or whatever abbreviation that is. I'm assuming it's some stuffed animals and maybe a friend. Possibly a gay guy. I'm just guessing. Here's the question they posed. My friends and I haven't read it since last time, by the way. I circled it, but I didn't read it, so I'm up against it here. My friends and I are collecting three-sentence stories from as many people as we can. Can you please write a story in three sentences for us? Well, I suppose I can. The girls asked for a story. The story was then told. When the story was over, he wondered, were they disappointed? The last one was one sentence. He wondered, comma, were they disappointed? Question mark. Daryl asked, thank you for your question, Rebecca Renee, et al. Greg Proulx ad hoc infinitum would like to answer the next question. As a current resident of New Orleans, Daryl asks, as a current resident of New Orleans, I was wondering how the constant barrage of disasters on the city looks to outsiders. Well, my goodness, Daryl, speaking of kittens and, what do they call it there? Etouffee? It looks terrible to us. I don't go there that much, so I haven't been in fact, I haven't been since before Katrina. And then, of course, subsequent to Katrina, the diaspora that the American government made the black people of New Orleans enact, separating them dog from family, family member from family member, putting people on planes that were just summarily told to get on planes. As I recall, we called that slavery if it had been a century before. And then, of course, the prison camp they were running down there that the oil company set up with that had the mesh wire fence and everything. And then the BP spill, which gave an extra piquant frisson to the proceedings. We've watched countless documentaries, the Spike Lee one, which was unbelievably illuminating and sensitive. Then the Greg Palast made one about New Orleans as well. And then, of course, Treme, that we're trying to deal with now and hope we like more. the thing about New Orleans is... And I know that people are going to go, look, Greg, we've only been listening a couple minutes and we were hoping for some jokes. I'm never, ever going to forgive Bush and Cheney for Katrina. I really am not. But they didn't make it happen. Yeah, they fucking did, okay? Some people have 9/11 theories. I've got a Katrina theory. Dick Cheney, inside his horrible, fevered fucking brain, has an unbelievable museum of laser beams that he can control in his mind, and he made that thing happen. It's not so much that they made it happen, it's that when it happened, they did fuck nothing. I was in Europe at the time. It's a very beautiful country. And I was in the city of England, and we were reading all the foreign papers and watching all the foreign TV. We watched Spanish TV, German TV, Italian TV, right? And the shot they kept showing was the two black people standing on that horrible little atoll with "Help Us" written there. And that's how the world saw that. They didn't see that, oh golly, there's so much going on, we're awfully busy and bureaucracy is difficult to organize. We have to put everyone in a baseball park and then come down 3 days later and go, gosh, heck of a job, Brownie. No one saw it that way. Everyone saw it as a horrible, hideous, fucking violent shot against New Orleans, which is what it was. And when a city has 500,000 people and then a city has 200 and something thousand people, that's a diaspora. There's no other way to, a pogrom, if you want to call it that, but it's definitely a diaspora. And so I think it looks like we all are rooting for New Orleans, because everybody roots for New Orleans. Who doesn't like New Orleans? Drunk, white, fat people can wear ponchos and wander down the street and have violent intercourse in corners and then projectile vomit on each other. Drunk black people with one eye can hassle you and sell you voodoo snakes and stuff like that. Every one of the rest of us can take a hurricane and toddle down the street with it until we're so violently ill from the sugar and the alcohol coursing through our systems and the bizarre ingredients of the muffuletta that we had no idea what was in it, and looking at things like alligator on a stick. We all root for New Orleans. The weather is ungodly in New Orleans. Just unbelievable. Like, it's like the planet Venus. It's just close. It's close. So I'm there with my sister, and we're outside the Café du Monde, and yeah, I have a family. Fuck you, Proopcast assholes. I have a family. I wasn't born in a shell like a lizard and whatnot, and fight my way out with one tooth, and then, you know, nip through the leather, and then end up in a coil underneath my mother's fucking scales. I have a family. We'd gone to see my family, and then after we went to see my family, my sister and I repaired to New Orleans so that I could drink for 48 hours. So we went to Decatur Street, and I remember a sign there that said, "Murders this year, 751. That was the old days, when there were people. And then we were outside the Café du Monde, and a little kid came up to me, of course, and hustled me, because New Orleans is all about that. And he goes, "I'll bet you $5 I can tell you where you got your shoes." And I was like, "He won't know because I bought the..." White people logic went coursing through my brain. I did the slinky logic. Look, it goes down the stairs one at a time. I went, "I bought these in England, and there's no way this young Negro New Orleans child will know this salient information. Even though he is a street hustler and has breached me on the street, I think I will be able to conquer this with some verisimilitude." So I said, "All right, you're on." And he went, "They's on your feet. That's where you got them, right?" And so there went the $5. And a lot of that was the last time I think I dealt with a dude on the street and actually thought I could take their shit on. We do nothing but pray for New Orleans, but it's because it's a place of intense black magic and amazing resonance to American history. The fact that jazz had its calamitous start there is beyond. And the fact that that's kept alive, along with so many other things like what we don't have in America, I think it's called the past. So it's imperative that New Orleans live and live forever. Also, I'm from San Francisco, and as I've often made the inapt analogy, San Francisco and New Orleans are two towns founded by drunks and prostitutes, and I wouldn't have it any other way. White guys in wigs, whatevs. In the last show, I said that Lemmy from Motorhead was in it. You all know who Lemmy from Motorhead, right? He was in Motorhead. And he talks like this, you know. And my understanding, Lemmy's rider is a pack of Marlboros, Lay's potato chips, and a bottle of JD. That is fucking awesome. I don't even want to hear what, like, you know, Jay-Z's writer is. He has to have, like, White Owl cigars when green or something, and, you know, I don't know, whatever. You know how it is. He would, like, I like strawberries, but they got to be vanilla, you know. Like, no, come on, man. That's uncool. Lemmy, I suggested, or inferred, or I stated outright, after Motorhead was in a group called Fastway, I have received more correspondence over this transgression than any moment of my career, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I've been in show business since 1954. I was on the original Addams Family show. I was on the Dumont Network when television was powered by steam pushed through a compressor. I've been around a while, and no one has ever really taken me on the way the Lemmy fans have come out of what I can only presume is the woodwork. And when I say woodwork, I mean actual woodwork, not even vinyl woodwork made to look like wood. Hi, Greg. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I'll skip down. I must correct something you said in the Counts episode. Fastway was not Lemmy's band after and before the reformed Motorhead. Fastway was actually Fast Eddie Clark, the guitarist band after Motorhead. Lemmy's band after Motorhead was Hawkwind. And I think it should be mentioned Fastway also included Pete Way, the bassist from UFO. Fast plus Way equals Fastway equals ingenious exclamation point. And that Fastway provided the soundtrack to the 1986 horror movie Trick or Treat, starring Gene Simmons, Ozzy Osbourne, and Mark Price, also known as Skippy from Family Ties. I would like to thank you, blah, 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 blah. And this is my favorite part, P.S. Postscript. I would like to thank you sincerely for making me feel like the hours and weeks I spent committing details such as the correct spelling of minuscule to memory might have served some sort of purpose. Thanks, Greg. He said minuscule later. I forgot to quote that part, however minuscule. Anyway, that was from Josh. Best wishes, Josh. And best wishes to you, Josh. I don't know what other kind of wishes people wish on one another. Does anyone ever come up to you and go, I'll give you some wishes, but they're not my best wishes. They're just wishes. It's Marilyn Monroe's birthday on the day of this recording. And aside from being hilarious and a goddess and troubled and a reflective metaphor for everything that we see in ourselves and a victim of the Kennedys and a thousand other things, the Norman Mailer Marilyn book is not a particularly beautifully written book. However, there's a picture of her on the beach in it that I think is my favorite picture of Marilyn because she has very little makeup on and it's dusk and she's kind of freckly and she's going like this and she looks a little high and she's got like a sweater pulled around her and she has her hair down. And that is my favorite picture of Marilyn. I mean, of course, boom, boom, out go the lights. But let's be honest. Mamie Van Doren, you know, whatever. Jane Mansfield, unbelievably funny. Marilyn Monroe was hilarious. I know that it's not a women's role model that's up to the moment because no woman wants to be a victim who speaks in a kind of a whispery, hilarious cartoon voice every moment of the day. I think we've moved on past that. But you have to remember the era she lived in. No one would go like this now. Oh, thank you so much, ever so. But she does, and it's hilarious. We were watching Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and her and Jane Russell are such a fantastic lesbian couple in that movie. They so don't need any man in that movie. They so don't need any man. I mean, I know she says diamonds are a girl's best friend. That's because she so doesn't need any man. And George Chakiris, next time you watch it, from West Side Story, is one of the chorus boys in the Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend number. Immortal. This was an article that I ripped out in December, and I rarely read the New York Times because I'm not a, what's the word? Dickface. And, are you suggesting everyone who reads it's a dickface? No, just the people who read the art sections first and then tell me about it. But I did read the New York Times because we were staying in a fancy place, and it was Maryland's Manhattan, public and private, and this guy lives in the neighborhood where she lived, in the 50s, and... there's all these cute pictures of her that you can't see on the Proopcast. There's one of her waiting for the subway here, looking very much like a Polish actress from an international artistic film from 1958, because it's all out of focus and she has white hair and her collar's up, and heaven knows why. And then there's a picture from Seven Year Itch. And then there's her leaning out the window of her flat. And it says, fantastically, estimates vary, but 2,000 to 5,000 fans and photographers lined up September 15th, 54, to witness the billowing dress sequence. She stood over a subway right in front. Monroe wearing an ecru Trevilla halter dress with accordion pleats and two pairs of white panties. She notes, in Marilyn, her life in her own words. Two pairs of white panties because, honey, yeah. You know, you don't want to see Christmas and New Year's. You know what I mean? There's Jungle Love and there's Jungle Love. Like, wow, I didn't realize we were going to see the Orinoco all the way back to the source. I thought we were just going to see the rich, fertile delta that led back to the creamy center of the nougat. I didn't know that we were going to see the bats and their friends. Stepped into the subway grate in front of the Trans Luke's Theater. Klieg lights and cameras hit her. The special effects men underground started the huge fan, and Wilder shot the scene over and over as the crowd roared. The Trans Lux, sorry, I said Luke's, has been gone for decades, but the subway grates on the west side of Lex are still available for photo shoots. The specific grate, alas, is not commemorated with the plaque, and the author says, but I recommend the sidewalk in front of Le Relais de Venise d'Entrecote, a bistro at 590 Lexington. So, if you want to go and take a picture of the great Marilyn stood over, you can go to 590 Lexington. The elegant Waldorf Astoria was Monroe's next home. She sublet a suite on the 27th floor and used the hotel stationery for her diary notes and poems, some of which have been reproduced in the 2010 book Fragments. Shed her ermine wrap in favor of a scarf and dark glasses. She read Russian literature, went to the Met, where she admired Rodin's Hand of God, or wandered up to 87th to buy smokes at the First Avenue smoke shop in jeans and a sweatshirt. And that just made my heart warm, that she went up and bought smokes on 87th and stuff. I know, you can titter quietly if you like. You may have noticed not every part of the show is thunderingly hilarious. Some parts include me basking in an unbelievable glow of halcyon days of yore, where a Klieg light hits me right across the eyes, and that's my key light. Wow, someone's phone going off? That's awesome. And I'm not going to rip you. I forget to turn mine off all the time. I live in my own special world of sepia-toned proopdom, where the whole world is in the past, as it always should be. Not the real past, because the real past was full of sexism and horror. But, you know, the fun past. My past. The past where Marilyn Monroe takes her Maltese Terrier, MAF, short for Mafia Honey. Yeah. Marilyn Monroe had a Maltese Terrier named Mafia Honey. She was married to Joe DiMaggio, who beat her ass after that fucking photo shoot. And she named her dog Mafia Honey. That is fucking hilarious. for walks in the park in Sutton Place. And then she would stare into space and mention names. And in her memoir, it says specifically, men's names. Mm-hmm. So happy birthday, Marilyn. I know you're up in heaven with Elizabeth Taylor right now. And I know what the fucking you two are getting up to. Kittens del Giorno. There's not a jar large enough. What was Marilyn's favorite meal? Potato chips and champagne? There's a girl who knows where she's going. I thought I'd start with that. Now we're moving into this. Mm. Wow, indeed. I rarely quote National Public Radio, or NPR as it's called, but I'm going to today because apparently all bets are fucking off. There was a Morning Edition ran a story called Foreign Accent Syndrome about a very rare condition in which brain injury seems to lead to a change in speech that sounds like the sufferer speaking with a foreign accent. No, I didn't fucking make this up, but I would have. I would have made up FAS, Foreign Accent Syndrome, which is what they're calling it. There's been 100 known cases since it was reported in the 40s. Dude, I'm from San Francisco in the 80s. I worked at a store called Red Peppers, which of course we called Red Peckers. And there was a girl there named Lydia, or as she called herself, Lydia. Because guess what? She had FAS. She was from Santa Rosa, California. But she talked like this, Greg. Hello, my name's Lydia. She dressed like Susie in the Banshees, right? With the white face, black eyebrows, giant black hair, purple headband, gum boots, fucking 1,000 skirts, a million bracelets. That fucking look. She wore a white kabuki makeup every day to work in a fucking store that sold candles and dinosaurs and shit. And she called herself Lydia. And I remember seeing her and going, hi, Lydia. And then years later going, hi, Lydia, how are you? And she's like, hey, Greg. And I'm like, oh, we're not Lydia anymore. And she's like, no, I'm not Lydia anymore. I'm just Lydia now. Madonna had foreign accent syndrome, remember? She moved to England, she married Guy Ritchie, and then all of a sudden it was like, I'm giving out the Turner Prize. It's the Turner Prize for art. That's what I'm doing. Like, I lived in England for 5 years, and after about a couple months, I started to pick, I mean, obviously I use the lingo, I say bloody and dosh and junk like that, and I'm never stop gonna, but, or gonna stop. But my wife said to me, you're picking up the accent, Greg, and you're being kind of an asshole. She goes, they don't want you to be one of them, so keep your fucking accent. I'm like, all right, I will. You'd meet people in London, and they go, hi, how are you? I'm going to the cinema. And you go, where are you from? And they go, Nashville. That's foreign accent syndrome. Gil Scott-Heron passed away. That's the biggest thing that happened since the last time we've spoken. Gil Scott-Heron passed away last weekend, and I know there's a lot of white people listening, so let me hip you to the down. Maybe you're not old enough to remember, or maybe you're just never ran into him in your world or whatever, or maybe you do know what I'm talking about, in which case you're already lighting a celebratory cool cigarette loaded with cocaine. Now, as Gil would have done. Gil Scott-Heron, to orient you immediately by the most famous thing, what he ever said or is attributed for saying, is he did a record called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which I believe ended up being a Nike ad at one point years ago. And everyone has overused to the point where it's as thin, you can read through it now, almost like Andy Warhol's, who said, in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. Not everyone will have 15 minutes of fame, but it got redone that way. And Gil Scott-Heron said the revolution will not be televised. You will not be allowed to cop out, he said. And he made an album called, what was it? Conversations on 125th and Lex or something like that. 125th and Lexington. Right. So his first, he's a black poet, jazz musician, artist, teacher, lecturer, I believe he called himself a bluesologist. A lot of rappers were influenced by him in so much as he spoke on his records. And because he spoke on his records, he was considered a proto-rapper or the godfather of rap, which he never owned. And the last article I read about him in the New Yorker magazine, when someone quoted him back that, you're the godfather of rap, he said, I think they made a mistake. His problem that he had with rap was that it wasn't significant enough and they weren't talking about politics enough because he was from the Afro-national era of poetry. Apparently the gig is this. He was an unbelievably bright child who his mother was single. His father, awesomely, had been a professional soccer player, played for Celtic, the only black guy playing for Celtic in the olden times in Scotland, in Glasgow. Well, he was far too precocious and bright and read too much poetry when he was little and got invited to be at a fancy prep school and whatnot and was playing the piano in the hallway until they put a sign on it that says, do not play the piano. And then he carried on playing the piano right under the sign, right? Well, his mother got called into the office and his mother, like, cleaned houses for a living. And she said, why am I here? And they went, your son's been playing the piano and there's clearly a sign on it that says, don't play the piano. Right? And he's the only black kid at this fucking school. And the mother's like, I told you to leave their shit alone. Right? And he's like, I played it because I wanted to. Well, he said, mom and him took a subway ride. And the mother didn't say a fucking word. And then she went, I told you to leave their shit alone. Don't play the fucking piano. Right? And he's like, okay. So anyways, he went on to make an album, Conversations on 125th and Lex. And then he wrote this song, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which I think a lot of us have heard. The reason why rap is born of him is, as I say, the political significance, the salience, and the absolute cogency of what he has to transmit to the listener. It's urgent. It's urban. It's with drums and bass. It's very rhythmic. And he had a beautiful declaiming voice that in no way can I recreate. Someone said it was like listening to Shakespeare, which indeed it was. I don't think he considered himself a rapper. And I think you can go back even further, obviously, to the blues and even Bo Diddley, who did several records that were simply spoken over jams. If the meaning of rap is the meaning of Public Enemy or any of the other rappers, KRS-One or the Furious Five, the people who really were laying down raps about politics and what was what, then yes. So apparently, Gil Scott-Heron went to a Last Poet show, and the Last Poets preceded him. They were Afrocentric rappers who kind of did poetry over drums and whatnot, a little more primitive than his bag, which he got into eventually, which was kind of a groovy jazz bag with his collaborator, Brian Jackson. So he went up to them at a gig when he was a teenager and went, "Would it be okay if I formed a group like your guys' group?" And they went, "Okay." So I guess what I'm saying to you guys is go out there and go back and listen to Gil Scott-Heron. And Johannesburg is one you'll want to listen to. Home is Where the Hatred Is. Winter in America. The Bottle. Angel Dust was a song when I was in high school, all about Angel Dust. Now, I'm from the Bay Area, as you know, my beloved San Francisco, and the Bay Area was awash in Angel Dust in those days, in the 70s. And people would smoke at PCP, we called it too, and it made you fucking crazy. And Gil Scott-Heron wrote a song about it. Please, please, if you're listening to the Proopcast right now, hang with me for two more minutes. Because I'm going to read you some lyrics by Gil Scott-Heron. He died at 62, and he smoked a lot of fucking crack, and he had HIV, and he was a mad heroin addict. I bet he mentions heroin more than any other fucking songwriter who took heroin. He has loads of mention, which he often calls skag, because he's from then. You've read a lot in the last couple days, if you've been reading about him, of praise, but also people say things like, well, he didn't fulfill his whole potential, or isn't it terrible that he died when he did, and things like that. And I think on the one hand, yes, it is. I had a very, very good friend who died quite young, and people said the same thing about him. I also remember Peter Cook, the astounding British comedian, who was also about 62, maybe 64 when he died, and he drank quite a lot and didn't do that much the last few years. Now, Gil Scott-Heron had been in jail off and on since maybe 12 years, and did a couple stretches for coke possession in that. But remember, this is America, and we put James Brown in jail, and we put Chuck Berry in jail and shit like that, so we really don't care who the fuck we put in jail. We put the author of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised in jail because he had some coke on him and shit. And guess what? He was a drug addict, so fuck you. My point is this. He did everything he could do, and he was wildly prolific. In the 70s and up until the 80s, till his record deal went away, he made loads of albums and wrote two books. So look at it that way. I'd prefer to celebrate Art Pepper, who's a genius saxophone player, also died in his 50s. And right before he died, he'd been to Synanon, he'd been to rehab a bunch of times, had some, was it blow or speed in his coat pocket, and got out of his hospital bed on his deathbed and did it, and then fucking died. And people are like, oh, that's terrible. It's like, no, he knew who he was. So here's a Gil Scott-Heron poem, and as he claimed about his own name, 1L, Gil, G-I-L, 2 T's in the Scott, and no I in heroin. This is from the first album, The Conversations at 125th and Lex, and you'll get the time period it's from. A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell with Whitey on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bill, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. The man just upped my rent last night because Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. Now, we were talking earlier about New Orleans, and that's exactly how I feel about New Orleans. Rather than go into a big diatribe about what evil cocksuckers Bush and Cheney are, Whitey on the moon is a metaphor, if you will, for all those kind of things that happen. Let's just change Whitey's on the moon to Whitey's in Iraq, and I think you get where I'm coming from on that one. So I would like you to go back and listen to Gil Scott-Heron if you have the time, and I'll leave you with this quote from him, which I thought was most salient because he was an intellectual. All the dreams you show up in are not your own. Yeah. So having said all that and having taken my live crowd down to a slow boil on this one, I think maybe the two rape stories I was about to jump into might not be the best way to dodge right now. Because, you know, there's been an awful lot of mail. Dominique, what was his name? Strauss-Kahn or DMK or whatever they call him. And then, of course, there was another guy today. I don't know if you were reading about that. By the time we read this, it'll be a regular story. A banker named Mahmoud Abdel Salam Omar, once the chairman of Egypt's Bank of Alexandria, now an executive at a salt production company, El Mex Salines, was staying at the Pierre Hotel on Sunday in New York when he called for a maid to bring him tissues. When she got there, oh, guess what he did? So now he's going to be arraigned. So this two millionaires in a two-week period. Men have a problem with rape, and the problem is this. If women don't want it, that's the problem. And apparently, if you're a rich man, calling for your maid is some sort of unbelievable fucking awesome rape time. Now, I stay in hotels pretty much every week of the year, and I never call for a maid thinking, this is the moment I'm going to jump out of the shower with my knob hanging out, because she's sure to have read Penthouse Letters 1984 like I did. Holy kittens, fellas. Did you give me the half hour light there, buddy? Wow, can you imagine? After reading Whitey's on the Moon and losing all listeners to Adam Carolla's podcast? I'd like to read you something that I got out of the Orange County Register, just so that you don't think everything is liberal by ass. The Patriot Act was reapproved and re-upped, if you will. It was to expire last week. President Obama, in between going golfing on Memorial Day and toasting the Queen over the God Save the Queen. If anyone saw the video, Obama was in London and he presented a toast to the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth II, II. And he started in and he went, well, this one's for Her Majesty. And then they started to play God Save the Queen. Well, no one in his retinue or entourage or whatever they're called, falderal, told him, you don't carry on talking while they play God Save the Queen. Everyone shuts the fuck up and stands there because she is, in fact, the imperatrix of their empire. She is like if Princess Leia was there and you went, nice buns on your head during the middle of her theme song, bum, 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 bum. No, it wouldn't play. So they're playing God Save the Queen, which to us is My Country, Tis of Thee. And Obama carried on talking. And another thing she did and blah, blah, blah. And the Queen shot her a look like, do you have a frozen salamander brain? Or what is the deal? Like, I'm not understanding why you don't get the smallest point of etiquette. So then the music stopped, and then he realized no one had been talking for the whole of the song. And then he went, anyways, Happy New Year's. And, like, threw her a toast and shit. You know, look out teeth, look out gums, look out stomach, here it comes, you know. Oh, kittens, Obama. Get some fucking, please get Miss Manners or somebody to fucking help you on those hard to get at. I understand dealing with royalty is a difficult situation. Not a lot of people deal with royalty on a regular basis. There's two things I know. You call the Queen Mum when you meet her. You don't call her fucking Queen or anything like that, or Liz. And you don't touch her. And you don't fucking give a toast during her fucking theme song. I mean, if they were playing the national anthem and someone was talking to you during the whole thing, if you had a foreign dignitary over here, say Sarkozy was over here, your little buddy who wears a big, you know, you wear an American flag on your lapel, Obama. You don't see Sarkozy wearing a big red French cock as the emblem of France on his lapel. He seems to remember what country he's in charge of. If they were playing the national, oh, say, can you see during the Yankees game? And he kept going, Monsieur, Monsieur, attention, attention, through the whole game. I have something I would like to say to you. You'd be like, shh, we shut up during this part. Well, that's what you should have fucking done. This is from the Orange County Register. Because when the Patriot Act was re-upped and renewed, he signed it with, what do they call it? A something pen? A CompuPen, an ExecuPen, an ElectroPen. He didn't actually sign it pen to paper. He signed it on a computer when he was overseas because he couldn't wait to sign the Patriot Act, which, by the way, if anyone will remember when he was running for president, and I think a lot of you will, you fucking Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, white bourgeois motherfuckers who I'm talking to out here, who remember every goddamn speech he gave and how great he was and how big a fucking bitch my girl Hillary was, you will remember that he said he wasn't going to have nothing to do with the Patriot Act, but here I am to remind you. And Whitey's on the moon. He called for repealing the original Patriot Act. Section 215 of the act gives the FBI virtually unlimited authority to obtain business records and other tangible things as long as they are, quote, relevant to an authorized investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. Wow. Well, I think we know what that means in this state of things. This is the Orange County Register, and I wanted to read you this part. Commendably, the extension was opposed by two Orange County Republicans, Representatives Dana Rohrabacher and John Campbell. Well, Dana Rohrabacher is not exactly balanced. So I just want you to know the Orange County Register came down on the left of this more than you did, one. And two, the Fourth Amendment was included among the original 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, because of the gross abuses by British tyranny. And because we've already dived this show into the fucking depths of the Marianas Trench, I am going to read you the Fourth Amendment because I just happen to have a copy of the Constitution with me here that I keep in a drawer at home. Do you really, Greg? Yeah, I fucking do, along with my Whitey on the Moon lyrics and my hacky sack and my teddy bear named Candy. The right of the people, search and seizure is Amendment 4, just so you're clear on that one. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated and no warrant shall be issued, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Does that what it sounds like to you? The Patriot Act means they can go on your computer and look at what you looked at. They can go to Borders and check your border card and see what fucking books you took out because you're in the Al-Qaeda because you didn't... Just so you know, and I thought that was kind of a bummer because this is supposed to be America and shit like that. And we killed Osama bin Laden and that was supposed to be such a great moment in dazzling freedom in history and I fucking swooned because liberty swooped over me with a fucking eagle clutching an olive branch and shit. Osama bin Laden died, and we're under his rules. So where the fuck does that go? You know what I mean? If this was really America, after killing him, we would have repealed the Patriot Act and gone, guess what? You're all off the fucking hook now, and I don't have to rub your balls when you go to the airport anymore, and you can bring a bottle of water on the plane. It's always about you, Greg, and everything you like. Yeah, it fucking is. All right, let's get to some Gwyneth news. I knew you were waiting for it. I know, Whitey on the Moon and all that shit. We're bumming out, Greg. When are you going to make fun of fucking Gwyneth for being a skinny bitch? Soon! I didn't say bitch. Gwyneth, this week, went on Twitter. And it's her first Twitter. And she went on Facebook as well and did a video and said, I'm joining the 21st century. I'm going on Twitter. And her first Twitter was, this is my first tweet. Dude, you need writers. Even if it is your first tweet, you have to write something like, eggshells are gray if you want to put them in a mulch pile. So on her site, Goop, and by the way, we share the same initials, GP, she talks about buying a wood-burning pizza oven. And I know what you're thinking to yourself, a wood-burning pizza oven? Do I have to live in Shakey's now? Who on earth has a wood-burning pizza oven? Gwyneth, yes. Well, that's clearly the answer. As a home cook, she says, let's stop right there. Well, I didn't think you worked in a restaurant, okay? Because I've seen you in movies and stuff. I didn't go, geez, Pepper Potts from Iron Man. She's got to get back behind the griddle soon, don't you think? American Charlie with red pants, burn 50, no name tag. I presumed you were a home cook, Gwyneth. Also, my mother was a home cook, but she never called herself that. She just called herself mom. Because that's what people who cook at home do. They just cook at home. One of the best things I've ever done was to build a wood-burning oven in the backyard. Now you're wording on that. You just said was to build. In other words, am I to understand that you built a wood-burning oven in your backyard in London? That you took mortar? That you got a cement mixer? That you laid down? I don't do, what do they call it, carpentry? I'm not familiar with contracting. I'm masonry. I'm kind of gay in that way, but not gay in a macho gay way. The right to bear arms. Just thought I'd scare you with that one. Am I to understand that Gwyneth Paltrow built her own wood-burning oven? I'm thinking someone came in and built it for her. Maybe I'm a cynic. There's pictures of her, though, if you please go on her Goop site, of her putting the pizza into the oven. Action shot from behind of her pushing the pizza into the oven. Many companies are making and installing wood-burning ovens, like Jamie Oliver and Mario Batali. Jamie Oliver and Mario Batali, to the best of my knowledge, are individuals. Not companies that come to your house and install wood-burning ovens. But I would appreciate it if you'd phone Jamie Oliver tomorrow and go, in between making fun of fat Americans, I wonder if you'd have time to come over to my crib and throw up a wood-burning oven in the backyard so that I can make pizza. Now, there's three things that should never be made at home. Donuts, French fries, and pizza's the third thing. My wife makes pizza at home and it's exquisite, but it's not at all like the pizza you get from a pizza place. Any way you slice it, homemade pizza just cannot be beat. According to Gwyneth, because she cannot use contractions. Otherwise, you'd say it can't be beat. This week's questions. Should we take some from the audience? Your call. Yeah, my call. This show's beached itself like a narwhal after Fukushima. We got some good ones. Let me entreat the crowd. Does anyone want to query me? Yeah, I thought not. Let's go to the ones on the paper here. Not getting a groundswell of enthusiasm. Matt. But I think we'll make it here. These are the Proopcast questions, if you wish to question me. Next week's show, by the way, is going to be different. We're at the Comedy Central space next week, recording. I don't even know by the time this gets out if that's salient. But two, next week's show is going to be a comedy special. You know, I thought Gil Scott-Heron, here's the thing. He was called the Black Bob Dylan. But let me get to something. Couldn't you have called Bob Dylan the Black Gil Scott-Heron? I mean, I don't mean to be a dickweed about this or anything, but Bob Dylan started before him and wrote more songs. Yeah, but Bob Dylan's songs are oblique, and he quit writing. Like, after Masters of War, when does Bob Dylan actually take on the thing? Gil Scott-Heron spent a fucking lifetime smoking crack and writing these fucking songs. I mean, when are we going to stop calling people the white this and the black that? Okay. Amendment number 6. The quartering of troops. If you quarter troops, they go longer. Then you get 4 out of each troop. Here are the Proopcast questions. Smartest@aspecialthing.com is the email upon which you may email me. And I do answer them, and I haven't read them. And here's the first one. From Ronnie. How can we solve the obesity epidemic in America? Oh, holy shit, Ronnie. I was hoping for a light one off the back of this fucking thing. I got an idea. Sit down and shut your mouth for a couple of minutes. That might help. How about that for glib? You know, there's a million ways. If I was Dick Gregory, I'd say be a fruitarian and eat only fruit or whatever. If I was Gil Scott-Heron, I'd have said smoke a shitload of rock and eat fruit because that's what he was doing before he died. The obesity epidemic in America is one that I've never been able to quite understand. When I was little, everyone was thin. If someone was 15, 20 pounds overweight, they were called fat. And if you watch movies from the 70s, what is it? There's a great movie called The Mac, speaking of blaxploitation films. And the bad guy's called Fats. And Fats is maybe 15, 20 pounds overweight? Fats is his name in the movie. Now, when you look at movies now or TV now, in fact, this morning I was watching VH1 because I'm an intellectual, and it was the 50 celebrities who've lost the most weight, and one of them was like Seth Rogen, and they showed him before and then after. And like, Seth Rogen's perfectly fine, but I don't mean to be a weenie, but who gives a shit if Seth Rogen weighs 25 more pounds than he does now? Does that really change the fucking, do you go like, oh, fuck, yeah. He's thinner now. I'm getting it. He was funny when he was chubby. He's funny when he's not quite as chubby. Jesus fucking Christ, you guys. But everyone was thin in the olden times. In fact, fat people were rich, and then poor people were thin, and then it's all upverted in the last 25, 30 years, and now fat people are poor and rich people are thin. So that's how we solve the obesity epidemic. A redistribution of wealth immediately, conducted by me right outside this bar right after the Probecast. Any rich person who comes by, I'm going to take their shekels off them and give them to a poor person, and then the poor person will be able to buy organic food at Whole Foods down the street. Thank you, Ronnie. Ula asks, I have a question for you, Ula. Were you in the movie Wonder Boys? Because you were the waitress in Wonder Boys. She says, I never forget a drink, and Michael Douglas in his stoned haze goes, and I never forget an Ula. What do you consider to be the most three important inventions in human history? Oh, thank fuck you asked. I have nothing but time to talk about this. Human history, as you know, is a series of mistakes followed by lies. Written by icky white guys who then rape their maid. Now, the three most important inventions in the human history are these. One, air conditioning. There is no question air conditioning is the most important invention of all time. But what about fire or the written word? That would have happened. If you've ever stayed in a place with no air conditioning, you know exactly what I'm talking about. 4 or 5 years ago, I was in Germany at the World Cup with Drew Carey. Drew, we were doing this TV show that no one watched on the Travel Channel. And they put us up in this one hotel in Stuttgart, and it had no air conditioning. And it was 1,000 degrees in Germany that summer. And then they put us in another one in Mainz, Germany, and the air conditioning was so unbelievably piss poor and weak. My description of the air conditioning in Germany was, it was being told a secret by a snake. It was like a lizard whispering an inference to you. It was a butterfly humming a tune in its head. That's how weak the air conditioning was. It was like, like, no! I want it booming. I want to freeze. I want to be freezing balls, okay? The second greatest invention of all time is being able to put your ATM card into the gas pump so that you don't have to go inside. Because the moment they stop pumping gas in America, which is another dark fucking day in this country's history, next to the day Gil Scott-Heron died and the day Ray Charles passed away, the day when people stopped pumping gas and the oil companies went, oh no, we're not just going to fuck you, we're going to bend you over and fuck you without lubrication now. And then, of course, I went to get gas the other day, $4.79 on my corner of my street. $4.79. Are we not bombing Libya into fucking submission right now? Is there not a reason why we're bombing Libya and why Syria is not having a revolution and why we're in Iraq and Afghanistan? $4.79? You got to be fucking kidding me. And no one pumps your gas and I got to check my own oil. I'm a sensitive artist. And the third greatest invention? Weed. But man didn't invent that. I know. But we thought of fucking cultivating it and putting it in little joints. Thank you, Ula. Jason, in your opinion, which artist had the greatest impact on modern art? Oh, Christ on a crutch. Pablo Picasso, Jackson Pollock, or Marcel Duchamp? Well, it's interesting you ask, Jason. Picasso, well, I mean, we were talking about this the other day. When I say we, I don't mean you. I mean me and my intellectual friends. We don't have much time left, do we? Seven? Ten. Picasso one, chased chicks and was as sexist as you could be. Of course, he was born in the 19th century, so throw a guy some. Secondly, he painted Guernica, which is an astounding painting that, if you recall, during the beginning of the Iraq conflict that we're winning, Colin Powell was brought to the United Nations and made to give a speech saying how imperative it was that we attack Iraq and how they were going to kill us and because they had all those weapons and whatnot. And it was in front of a painting of Guernica. And the Bush administration hung a cloth a curtain in front of Guernica so that the painting of Pablo Picasso's Guernica wouldn't be seen. Now, I'll hip you, in case you're running a little behind. Guernica was a battle where the fascists bombed this town in northern, in the Basque country of Spain, into absolute rubble and submission, and children died, and women and children. It was during lunchtime in the regular day, and the Nazi planes, because Hitler's Nazis had supplied them with the planes, bombed the living daylights out of Guernica. So Picasso did this sort of hyper-surreal painting. There's a screaming horse head, and there's people dodging and whatnot. It's not a literal painting of a bombing, but if you see it, the symbolism is so powerful that it makes you, well, this is how afraid the Bush administration was of the public's opinion of the Iraq War. They covered the painting of Guernica because it's clearly an anti-war painting, so that Colin Powell could go, well, we need to bomb Iraq and blah, blah, blah. In other words, a screaming, symbolic 1930s horse head was such a powerful emotive image that it had to be covered by our government so that we couldn't see it and make some sort of alliterative movement in our own mind to put that in context. So Picasso's important. Pollock, of course, rolled with a bunch of other straight white guys and drank a lot. I can't blame him for that. Hey. And I hate the argument, oh, a child could do it, therefore it's not good art. Fuck you. A child doesn't know what to fucking do with their lifetime of experience. Was it James McNeil Whistler when he had to go to court when he sued the critic because he had done a splash on a black bluish backdrop of a firework? And the guy went, a child could do that. And he went, ah, but it's taken my whole life to know where to put that fucking splash. And Marcel Duchamp. Now, I watched a documentary about Duchamp that made me never, ever want to fucking look at another Duchamp piece of art in the rest of my life. He is an explosive artist, but I don't... Okay, we're getting a little not funny here. In your opinion, which artist had the greatest impact on modern art? Walt Disney. Chris asks, what do you think of Ron Paul? I prefer him to Rand Paul. Next question, Martha. Every day I wake up to a world surrounded by fear and hatred. That's not a question. I recently turned 18 and I'm beginning to realize that the change the world needs now rests with my generation. What advice can you give me in order to help us create a better world? One, you must buy a Gil Scott-Heron record. Two, don't. I've said this so many times on the show. Anything you see on TV, anything you read that's from a newspaper, don't believe it. Think about it and go seek out your own sources of information, and then you'll be able to put fucking two and two together. Not that I can. As you say, the change the world needs now rests with your generation. Apparently not my fucking generation. I got written out in your fucking history, Martha. Remember, you're a woman. Remember that. Your generation needs to remember that. Feminist isn't a bad thing. Feminist only means that you believe in women and what women should get in this fucking world. I'm so goddamn sick of hearing liberal and feminist used as pejorative terms. Liberal only means that your mind is open to other ideas. It doesn't mean that you go to Whole Foods all the time and hate Sarah Palin. And feminist only means that you care about what happens to women, not that you have hairy underarm pits and hate fucking men and shit. There are men with hairy underarm pits who hate other men, and they are not feminists. They are douche dubages, and they run the fucking world and rape maids. Get up on that, Martha. Tom asks, how would you try and convince someone that you love to that you love to leave some of the grammar. Sorry to take out the pen, you guys. I got to correct this. How would you try and convince someone that you love to leave, that you would love to leave? Or is there, what are we missing? Simi Valley and start a real life. How would you try and convince? Well, honey, Tom, leave Simi Valley. You have a car, right? I'm guessing you have a Toyota with Yo painted on the back. Get in that and fucking leave Simi Valley, sweetie. Tyler asks, other than Orwell, which dystopian novels would you recommend? One called We by Zamat Yen. I can't think of his first name. He's a Russian writer from the 20s. And that one, the government orders everyone to have a lobotomy, and they all have to go to a place and have their brain removed. That's a very good dystopian. Utopia by Thomas More, I think, is the first one. Haven't got all the way through it. 16th century writers, hey, a little harder to get through than 20th century writers. I'll be honest about that one. Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, of course, because it encompasses so many things that we have to deal with every day now. We're talking about genetic engineering in that book more than any other book, right? The Bakunovsky method. What is it? 86 pairs of identical twins? I can't remember. And everyone has their life taken away from them. And this is the part, I think, that's so salient about Huxley is, one, they have orgies every week at their work, right? And they all get around together, and like we're in a room here together, and they slap each other and they ask, what is it? Orgy, porgy, Ford, and fun. Kiss the girls and make them one, right? So sex has been depersonalized like the government has done to us with the internet and pornography, right? Pornography is so ever-present now, and millions of people watch pornography all the fucking time, and then people say things like that are addicted to it. I can't relate to people anymore, or I don't understand what women are like. Let me tell you something. When I was young and pornography was hard to come by, being alone with a naked woman, no matter what she looked like, was the biggest fucking thrill in the world. It was like flying on a blimp with no fucking... That's right, goddammit. And the same works both ways. With women in the 60s and 70s, being with a naked man, they were like, holy shit! So you need to read Huxley as well. Did someone else mention one that I heard?
J.G. Ballard.
Oh, J.G. Ballard. Well, which one would you pick? Crash or... Which one?
High-Rise.
Oh, High-Rise. There's a goodie. Mike McShane, my old mate. High-Rise by J.G. Ballard. What happens is they get caught in a high-rise building, and there's no more water, electricity, none of that. So they're forced to live like animals. And so they end up killing the neighbor's poodle and roasting it on the fucking roof of the building and shit. And as it progresses, it's a bit like Lord of the Flies. They realize that they like it more. Which is the world I think we would all like if we didn't tweet every 2 seconds and weren't on the computer every second. Having said that, you can follow me on iTunes, which is where you can pick this up. Hal asks, out of all the actors to portray James Bond, who's your favorite and why? And no, I'm not going to say George Lazenby to be a contrarian or Roger Moore, even though I met Roger Moore once at a gig in England years ago. And I went, hi, Roger Moore. I'm Greg Proops. And he went, oh. And just was absolutely mortified that I even spoke to him. Like, he was revulsed, repulsed, disgusted. I can't describe to you the look on Roger Moore's face when I came up to him. It was as if I was a bowl of soup and a fucking worm had just crawled out of the middle of the soup and went, hey, everybody, how's it going? It was really bad. Sean Connery. Now and forever. Daniel Craig's cool. You know why? He's a little bit sadistic. He has the sadism Sean Connery had. Sean Connery had something else. What was that, Greg? A giant 9-foot weenie! Nate asks, has your love for the Giants ever faltered through your long-standing fandom? If not, what would you have to happen for you to question your allegiance? Oh, we don't have that much time. We really don't. I'm going to have to circle those. Someone named R-A-U-N. How do you pronounce that name? Rune? Raun? Raun? Rune? Christ on a crutch. Roan has a question. We'll answer that next week. The Giants question, Nate. I'm going to give you a brief answer, and then I'm going to expatiate on this a lot longer in a week's time at the Comedy Central space. My love for the Giants has faltered at several moments. Those moments are indelibly etched in my mind. Much like Trajan's triumph over the Parthians was immortalized in a giant column that now stands in the Forum in Rome, hundreds of feet tall and with thousands of figures etched in it by hand. There's no way of describing the detail with which my fandom of the Giants has gone down in history. The Egyptian Book of the Dead is but a reminder of how detailed my allegiance to the Giants is. Yes, there have been times. Here's two brief ones. Darrell Evans, who played third for us for 8 years, from the late 70s into the 80s, and once hit 3 home runs in a game, and then was traded to the Detroit Tigers and hit 40 home runs for them. I was at a night game with my friend Jay Nacido in 1979. Two men on, two out. Daryl Evans came up. Daryl Evans had a pop fly playable, and the PA announcer at Candlestick Park went, "Thanks, Daryl." Yeah, to the 1,000 people that were in the baseball stadium, the PA announcer had his foot on the mic, opened, and went, "Thanks, Daryl," like that, and fucking dissed a major league ball player in his own ballpark for hitting a pop-up playable. That was but one moment. Are there others that are more thrilling and perhaps relatable? Yeah. It was also Willie Mays' birthday this week, and as I've said so many times, Willie Mays lives in the sky like the constellation Orion. We'll reconvene in 1 week's time at the Comedy Central space. I don't know when's this one come out? We're doing so many this month. Prodigious Proopcast. Paltry Humor Proopcast. What was it? All right, this one will go out Friday. So by the time this one goes out Friday, it'll again be next Wednesday, in which case you can join me at the Comedy Central space. And then for the last two Wednesdays of this month, we'll be right here again at the friendly confines of Bar Lubitsch. I want to thank you very much for listening if you're out there in podcast land. And if you're here at the Bar Lubitsch, I want to thank you extra special for sitting through the moments together that we have shared. Faded photographs, memories of forgotten places, tickets torn in half, traces of love long ago that didn't turn out right. My name's been Greg Proops. This is The Smartest Man in the World. Peace out. Greg Proops is doing a podcast, and Whitey's on the moon.